Thank you very much. I was really delighted to be here, and thank Penny very much for inviting me. And I was very delighted to get the invitation. And then I looked at what I had to do, and I got really daunted. I thought, but how can I talk about mental health and the family in half an hour, right, when it probably takes 3 days at least? So as I'm a bit daunted, I'm going to possibly daunt you a little bit. And I hope to help that by one, I may not get through all my slides, but it doesn't matter because Penny's very kindly said they'll send you copies of the slides without the videos on electronically. And also you've got some handouts of some of the slides, the ones that have got too many numbers in them that I don't want to have to go over. So this thing of mental health is, of course, as everybody says, now in the news. It's true there's a lot of attention, but actually much less activity than the attention suggests. And you probably know these recent frightening figures that 24% of 14-year-old girls have been depressed. 166,000, I think that's just England, and 9% of 14-year-old boys. So one has to try and think, what does it actually mean to understand mental illness? And what does it actually mean to young people? So I'm going to introduce you to four young people aged 14 up to their 20s. You're going to meet them twice. They're all young people who have experienced, I'm going to say not mental illness, but problems with their mental health. But they also have had parents who have had overt mental illness. And so they've been dealing with both, or at least one in relation to the other. So just listen to what they say.
How would you define a mental illness?
Can we put this
up? Something that impacts your day-to-day well-being and your ability to cope with normal, everyday tasks.
Fine.
Mental well-being and your mood and your frame of mind.
That mental illness is, from what I know, mental illness is something that impacts your mental health. So many of your thoughts and emotions are mixed up, which affects your day-to-day activities as well.
Guess it's something that is mental, not physical, and that affects you and others. Like, it could make you or others unhappy, or you might not be aware of it. But I guess the key thing is that it's all in the brain, really.
Something that affects the brain, your thinking, your mind, your behaviour, and it can be biological as a result of the environment, or the way you think.
Oh, and I always thought that it was because I'm a female, I'll be the next in line, and I'm the oldest as well. So,
okay, so that just starts us off. Now, I'm going to just use a definition of mental illness, which is that everything that happens to us is part of our rich pattern of our lives. Illness is when it gets out of your control. It's a simple definition. So rather than say that, you know, we talk about mental health issues and mental health problems and mental health, which often young people I talk with say, I've got mental health, doctor, what should I do about it? I said, hold on to it as long as you can. Okay, so here's a little schema. Because you'll hear many discussions about nature and nurture, as Roz referred to. They're really a waste of time because there really isn't any nature without nurture and any nurture without nature. And I think one way I've found useful to think about it is as a wheel. Now, it's a wheel because these things don't summate. They drive each other. Each bit of it makes the other more potent. So we all have our genetics. That's something that we are born with, and generally speaking, they're relatively stable, unless you get mutations. We also have something which is becoming more and more talked about. We have a vast amount of evidence about it, called epigenetics, which is something which goes against previous theories of genetics, which were anti-Lamarckian, which basically says that we can change what we inherit, even if it's not through genes, in our lifetime. And it's not always negative. Sometimes, for example, effects of people who are alcoholic, the next two generations may actually have developed certain enzymes which can be protective of alcohol. So we also have our own developmental strengths and deficits that we experience, which are both a combination of nurture and nature. And then we have our previous family environmental pattern, the things that happened, that are the dances we got into with our family members when we were growing up. Now, it's important to say that because quite often for many people, they talk about the past, but for many people, of course, the past is still happening. You know, the relationships you used to have may actually still be the ones which, even though you didn't really want it, you know, you've gone off to America, like a young woman I saw yesterday, and is, you know, an independent young woman, and she comes back home and she becomes a little child again, and all the old dances start all over again. And so we have those two, and then there is what I'd call the developmental family environmental pattern. All I'm saying is, you don't really have an illness. Any illness has elements of all of these. So don't get involved in saying whether it's nature or nurture, because it's probably irrelevant in most cases. Now, I've just put this slide up. I'm not going to go through it. This is CAMHS, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services. You've got this on the handout, and you can see the sort of stuff that CAMHS Tier 2, which is meant to be non-specialised clinics. I think we've got some CAMHS workers here. And CAMHS Tier 3 or Tier 4, which are specialised services. And you can just look at, you can see the kind of list of things they're supposed to do. And you can also know that they can't do it. One, because they have huge waiting lists. And two, because they're grossly under-resourced. So that's the way we are. Not only that, there we are, there's plenty of it, yeah. That's an important one. I actually had a wonderful slide, which I couldn't find again. But basically what it said is it looked at a range of child mental health problems or child psychiatric disorders, whichever word you include, and less than 50% of them were always getting to any kind of intervention at all. So, you know, we need to think. And it's and the other thing that's important about that is that it doesn't relate to severity. There's no correlation between the severity of disorder and the assumption that you'll get help. So, how many of you heard of ACE research? Five, okay, that's a good crowd. Well, it's really important. It's even affecting governments, which is extraordinary. Even our department of, no, not our department, the Welsh Department of Health has heard of it and they're doing something about it. ACE is adverse childhood experiences. Now, none of us should have had them, should we? I mean, anybody had an adverse childhood experience? I'm not going to ask you to answer yet. But they do tell us some important things. So these are the sorts of things that you might experience as an adverse childhood experience. And these are the sort of percentages. I won't go through them. They're easy to read. They're obvious. Now, if you have one adverse childhood experience, you see that a total of 26% of us have one adverse childhood experience. So it's one in four, at least, right? But if you have four or more, you have a life expectancy of 20 years less. That's a bit dramatic, isn't it? But the research is really remarkably convincing. So I put this slide in. They're rarely asked about in clinical service. In the English study, nearly 47% of people experience one ACE, 9% of the population having four or more. So 9% of the population. So it's not just affecting people's mental and emotional development, but actually affecting their future physical health. There it is, 20 years earlier. Now, why is it important? Well, it's important because despite the fact that it's called adverse childhood experiences, things that happen to little children, things that happen to adolescents and things that happen to adults. To some extent, at each point in the life cycle, you can actually do something about it. If you think about it, you know about it, and you're prepared to. These are some of the illnesses that actually increase. So depression, hepatitis, chronic pulmonary lung disease. Now, what I've done is I've given you two little films, and these are the URLs, which are really worth watching. This one is a little animated film produced in Wales by the Welsh government, and it's absolutely brilliant, I think. This one is a more academic one, of which tells you about ACEs, what are the source of ACEs, and what's the consequence. So you've got that, and you'll get the PowerPoint.
What's happening to me right now means I'm more likely to have serious health problems in middle age and die sooner than I should. I'm getting used to being scared all the time, but now I'm just angry. Doctors say things are changing inside me. My brain isn't learning how to control my feelings properly. My body can't relax like those kids who don't have ACEs, so my body won't be able to repair itself properly when I get older, making it more likely I'll get cancer or heart disease as an adult. It hurts when my parents hit me, but the real damage is hidden, and that damage will be with me for life.
Now, I took two clips and edited them together, just so you know, but that's just to give you a flavour of how that little video works. So the good news is actually that they can be reversed. And also, of course, the other good news is that children are remarkably resilient if they're given a chance. And this is where the family comes in. Because we don't always give them a chance, and it isn't that difficult to give them a chance. That's what I'm going to suggest to you. That is the thesis of today. Now, my own personal practice is... I always work in a family context. That doesn't mean to say I always do family therapy. It doesn't mean to say I always see the whole family the whole time. But I go in and out of who I think needs to be seen in what context when. So quite a lot of my practice used to be little monsters. They're called 2 to 5 year olds who scream and shout and frighten their parents. And they're very easy to work with because the parents are usually very muddled and all you have to do is to help them lower the emotional, it may sound easy, but lower the emotional tone and work together and stop being dominated, just like that. Now, then I see quite a lot of eccentric, angry or anxious 5 to 11 year olds. Quite a lot of confused, depressed, obsessive or challenging young people, challenging with sex, alcohol, drugs, conflict, depression, avoidance or withdrawal. And then what I'd call stunned young adults, confused, angry, who are complaining and can't understand why they can't get their parents to be cured of their previous failings. And there are quite a lot of these young adults I see who are still trying to improve their parents without success, usually. And then I see miscellaneous family and post-divorce conflicts. A lot of my work is also linked to parental mental illness. So a lot of the young people I see are children of parents with mental illness. We know that there are something like we used to think it was 2 million from the SCI survey, Social Care Institute of Excellence. A recent survey done by, not Christ Waterhouse, one of the other big accountancy firms who's been consulting for us in our charity, found that it's probably 2.7 million children living with a parent with mental illness in the United Kingdom. Now, the government acknowledges something like 190,000 young carers, so there's a big discrepancy in understanding what's going on and the actual state of affairs. So, what's a bad idea in the family if you're going to work with them? First of all, it's a bad idea to assume that the way the family has defined a problem in one person is a useful one. It's a possible one, but it may not be useful. To accept that any one person's definition of what is happening or has happened. So you do actually have to accept And this is really where we get, I think, to what Roz was talking about, a theory of mind. It is a business of accepting something that you might think is obvious, which is that people can have different points of view. I sometimes have said to some parents, do you actually think in your family, no, well, usually to one parent who's dominating, that it is that the people in your family have a right to different points of view? Oh, of course, of course, of course. But you can see that actually there's been an absolute injunction about against any different points of view. Secondly, to collude in conflict avoidance of uncomfortable topics. And lastly, to assume that those who speak little or none do not have a valid view to express. And what's a good idea? To assume there may be different and valid points of view. To challenge the assumption that if you don't agree with me, you don't love me. Now that little, if you like, narrative, if you ask people if that in a family, do you think that? Of course not. No, of course not. But actually, it's a hidden narrative in nearly all families to some extent. We all like to think we can disagree and have different points of view, but actually, we all have issues about loyalty and why are they disagreeing with me and why don't they understand my point of view and mine must be right. To help the family recognize positives in each other, particularly in those being only defined in negative ways. To challenge assumptions about power and rights. So it's power often between genders, usually male in relation to female, but not always, and in the adults or children. And to just demonstrate that conflict and disagreement can be faced usefully. And to challenge invalidation. Now, that's rather an important one. In the research on borderline personality disorder, it used to be thought that many of the young people, and they were predominantly young women, because those were where, predominantly but not only, where borderline personality disorder tended to be most easily, or most commonly, I should say, diagnosed, that it used to be thought that it was related to abuse. And then a study suggested it wasn't actually abuse, it was a particular form of deprivation. And it wasn't deprivation of physical things, and it wasn't deprivation of cuddles. It was deprivation of a particular kind of emotional interaction, in which the adult parent validated, reinforced, confirmed the child's experience. And so the child's experience was floating all over the place, and they never really learnt to regulate their emotions and their thoughts. That's a quick. Now, what are the key ingredients that in my own practice? I encourage dialectic with children and young people. I encourage adults to help children not think that it's always useful to submit to the adult point of view. Avoid reverence to symptomatic behaviours. They tend to be very powerful. She's anxious. Oh dear, we mustn't do anything. Demonstrate that humour is not dangerous and use it, if you can. Through the use of cool questioning, now I'll try and illustrate that in a minute, and dialectic, help young people or adults who feel they cannot be heard validate their experience. And you find if you can do that, just acknowledge something which is being poo-pooed, that often a lot of noise and emotional outbursts just disappear and only intervene as much as is useful and necessary. Now, here's Uzma, who's another of the young people who has had mental health problems but is a parent with mental illness. I asked her, so what do you want when you see a counsellor or a therapist? She's 14.
I don't think it matters really. Someone who you can confide in, you can talk to, who you think you can trust. Someone who has a good impression on you, or who is friendly in your view, or who takes your opinion and your say into account. It doesn't have to be anything specific. Like, they have to have empathy and understanding. And they have to value what you say and take into account things that you might be feeling.
OK. Okay, pretty, you know, it's not rocket science, that, is it? Okay. So, I'm going to show you now a clip of the four young people you saw describing their resilience. What do they do to deal with their own feelings? Because, as what Usma says, of course, is, you know, it doesn't have to be a therapist, a counsellor, a professional. It could be, somebody, an uncle, an aunt, a friend, somebody you can actually do those things with. That's what matters. But then sometimes they have to do something themselves, and this is what they do.
And I see my parents a couple of times a week, but I'm not as involved. I'm making sure that I still am doing my own things and making my decisions. I sing occasionally, but yeah, I'm really throwing myself into some stuff, into my career.
I'm currently working, so I've got like 3 jobs. I'm a student as well. I'm doing my master's now.
I started a YouTube channel, so I compose songs and stick them on there, sometimes with the help of my friend who makes my music videos, and the most popular one is called I Want to Be a Duck, and has managed to get over 150,000 views, which I'm quite happy about. And that's nice, and I mean, I also make like some other videos singing other people's songs, just vlogs about what I'm angry about or whatever. And then I also do a lot of running. I just feel really terrible if I don't have sport on a particular day.
And for me, as well as studying and working, I enjoy listening to music and writing songs and singing. And I occasionally sing at different events.
Okay. So, that's an encouraging story. So here's a few messages for the family. That, you know, if you want to tell your family what to do or tell your parents how to do it, if it's usually the... Encourage debate and dialectic. But, you know, with adolescents who love dialectic and debate, hold your ground about what really matters. Now, that's the tricky one. What does actually matter? And that you've got to work out. You may rely on your religion or something, but the more you can do it yourself, the better, and think it out. Because the more you feel constrained by other forces that decide what should be important, the less free you are, rather simply. Avoid conflicts about trivial bees in people's bonnets. They really don't matter. Remember that warmth and pride is a key tool for change. People can change when they feel good and when they feel pride. And when they feel cold and they feel shame, they can't change. They tend to dig their heels in. Avoid confusing disagreements with betrayal, as I said, if you don't agree with me, you don't love me. Be open about your own feelings in the family as a parent, but do not invade a child or young person with what they cannot use or do not need to understand about oneself. I'll give you an example. I saw a couple 2 days ago, and I said, look, you know, it might be useful for you to tell your only child daughter, who's 15, that you've been to see me because she's been suffering all this tension in the house. Oh, it would absolutely terrify her. She'd think we're getting divorced. I couldn't possibly mention it. I couldn't say that we've done anything like this. Eventually, after the second time I saw them, I encouraged them to, and they did. And she said, that's interesting. What sort of things did you talk about? Did you talk about me? Not yet, they said. Because actually she'd been totally dominating the family. Beware the child becoming a parent or the couple's caretaker. Of course, that's impossible to avoid. Children always do become caretakers, especially little ones, always looking after their parents, worrying about their feelings. But specifically avoid the child becoming a go-between, or absolutely don't allow the child to communicate either between or about particularly separated parents. That's an absolute no-no. In a repartnered stepfamily, be careful not to delegate authority to the stepparent until he or she has earned the child's respect. It's one of the biggest mistakes in stepfamilies. In a repartnered stepfamily, openly discuss the child's experience of changes in their ordinal position. They were top dog, and then another stepchild comes in who's older or younger or in the middle or whatever. Right, actually, that's the end of my talk. That's quick, wasn't it? Now, some people say to me, what do you mean by dialectic? Well, this is a very mild example with Ambeya, who's getting very upset. I'll tell you why she's upset, first of all. This was a bit of filming we did with these young people to help other young people think about the effect on themselves of parental mental illness. And it was all very positive. And Ambeya said, you know, listening to you all being very positive has actually made me feel worse because my situation isn't as good as that. And when we came down to what it was actually she was the only one who took the responsibility not just to get the mental health crisis team in, but finally to say, look, we can't go on like this, because the mother had been extremely violent, had broken all the locks in the house and the doors, had been fights with neighbours, been fights with the father, who'd become alcoholic and gambling and had gone off and left her really to manage it. She was the eldest. And she'd eventually had to force them to put her in a secure unit, the mother, which was quite a long way away. And she felt terrible. And so she blamed herself, felt terribly guilty. So, oh yes, you can run that for me.
But before, I used to talk to people all the time if something was getting to me. But now, because of the guilt, I've held it in. When you blame yourself.
I asked her what guilt was.
Your mum going away this time up.
Do you agree with yourself when you blame yourself?
I don't want to agree with myself.
But do you? I mean, do you think you're right to blame yourself? I know you do blame yourself, but do you think you're right?
I know it's wrong, but in my head, okay, it's right.
So that's a job that some young people will have to be helped to do, to have that argument between knowing that it's wrong to blame themselves and blaming themselves.
That's just a sort of example of the kind of discussion which I encourage, okay? Sometimes more debate than that, but that's just an example. Well, I think I'm in time. Isn't that extraordinary? I could have a question, couldn't I?